Hi, listeners. It's Tucker Ligursky. As a researcher on Masters of Scale, I use the innovations of AI on a daily basis. And with an increasingly overcrowded market, it's hard to discern which ones are truly beneficial for my work, not to mention safe. That's where Grammarly comes in. My job requires me to prepare dozens of documents every day. And with Grammarly, I'm able to make my dossiers and research documents clear, more direct, and more concise. In fact, I recently discovered that Grammarly users spend 66% less time editing content, which is a huge advantage since our most precious resource is undoubtedly time. What I love about Grammarly is its commitment to responsible AI. My team works tirelessly to produce top-quality podcasts, and it's vital that we keep our data secure. Grammarly has been around for 14 years and has maintained a business model dedicated to never selling your data, which means you can trust it with your most sensitive information. Join me and over 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Visit Grammarly.com to learn more. That's Grammarly.com.
When I travel for work, I often find myself caught in a blur of meetings and hotel rooms, and I miss out on what the city I'm visiting can offer. I'm sure you can relate. That's exactly why I wanted to recommend a new podcast from our team that changes this paradigm. It's called Offsite Adventures. It turns a simple work trip into an unforgettable adventure. In each episode, we reveal hidden gems in the most iconic business travel destinations. Just search for Offsite Adventures in your favorite podcast player. The show is produced by the same team behind Masters of Scale and presented in alliance with Capital One Business.
What we are doing is not enough, and it's not happening fast enough. There's a revolution underway, and in real revolutions, there are winners and there are losers. One monster objective, it's the mother of all OKRs, and that's to take 59 gigatons of greenhouse gas emissions. That's the carbon pollution that we pour into our precious atmosphere every year as if it's some kind of free and open sewer, down to net zero by 2050. This is a tall order. In the early days of the internet, I kicked up something of a firestorm by declaring that the internet had been underhyped. And I'm of the same view about the climate transition. The transition from the dirty fossil fuel economy to the new clean energy economy is, I think, the greatest economic opportunity of the next century.
That's legendary investor John Doerr, partner at Silicon Valley venture firm Kleiner Perkins. As author of the new book Speed and Scale, John is aggressively goading business leaders and all of us to address the climate crisis with existential urgency. I'm Bob Safian, former editor of Fast Company, founder of the Flux Group, and host of Masters of Scale Rapid Response. I wanted to talk to John because rather than simply rail about the need for change, his new book quantifies what specifically is needed in six discrete areas to achieve a carbon-neutral world. John isn't arguing that we all need to be vegan ascetics. He talks about the need to go for the megatons and the critical role that business plays in advancing that movement. He also talks about the huge economic opportunity that decarbonizing is unlocking across all industries and enterprises. To win the battle to preserve the planet, he says, we need to apply lessons of speed and scale more broadly and more aggressively than ever before. I'm Bob Safian. I'm here with John Doerr, partner at Kleiner Perkins and author of the new book Speed and Scale about the climate crisis. John is coming to us from California as I ask my questions from my home in New York. John, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. I love your program and it's an honor to be on it.
Well, thank you. As an investor, you've backed some of the world's most successful entrepreneurs, from Amazon to Google, many, many more. You authored the influential book Measure What Matters, Spreading the Gospel of OKRs, Objectives and Key Results. And you've also been involved with addressing the climate crisis through investment and now through Speed and Scale. But I wanted to start by asking you about the COP26 conference in Glasgow in November. There were many high hopes going into it, but it didn't quite go as it might have. You were in Glasgow for the conference. I'm curious what your experience was like, what you were expecting, and what happened.
Well, more than 200 nations send representatives, ministers, to the COP, the Conference of the Parties Conference. First COP I've attended, but it was an imperfect mix of both progress and disappointment. The bold commitments that were made were to curb methane emissions and to halt and reverse the loss of forests. There were also steps taken to align the finance sector with net zero emissions by 2050 and to retire the internal combustion engine. There was agreement to phase out fossil fuel subsidies. All the parties agreed to return in 2022, that's in 1 year, with stronger 2030 emissions targets to align them with net zero by 2050 and try to get to the still possible goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that's what the science tells us we must do, Bob, to avoid a runaway climate disaster. Okay, so everything I've said so far is the good news. The bad news, what came out of Glasgow is too little and it's too late. If the countries fulfill their full plans, this is based on UN data, the Earth will be 2.5 degrees Celsius warmer by the end of the century, which is terrible. There's also quite a credibility gap. A number of countries set 2030 targets that are so weak that they don't credibly support a net zero by 2050. And I'm going to call them out. Australia, Brazil, China, Russia, and Saudi Arabia. There was quite a contentious debate around the notion of climate injustice. Should the nations of the world that have emitted this carbon pay for that, as you would if you owned a home and your neighbor engaged in actions that ruined your home? There's no agreement on that, and I think it leads to a larger conversation around climate justice and redressing longstanding inequities in the world. One of the most important developments out of COP was a bilateral agreement between China and the U.S. And despite all of the tensions in trade and human rights issues that exist between the world's two great superpowers, their leaders came together and said they are going to meet regularly and work in many areas, methane, coal, carbon capture, to try to do better than China's commitment, which is net zero by 2060. That's 10 years at least too late.
It sounds like the people who are there, like, they are taking it seriously, which may be a difference from, you know, years ago, but they're not moving aggressively enough or fast enough.
What we are doing is not enough, and it's not happening fast enough. To the credit of the hardworking ministers of environment and government leaders who were there, it's hard for them to get very far ahead of their populace, ahead of their people. And so there's no point making a pledge that you cannot enact into policy when you return to your nation. And the participation in all of this is voluntary. There's no UN authority that will force a nation state to do whatever we believe is the right thing. This is not some kind of green party that we're having and everyone comes together, kumbaya. There's a revolution underway, and in real revolutions, there are winners and there are losers.
I want to ask you, the solution that you write about in the book is to sort of apply the measure what matters formula to climate efforts, right? That the way to get to a net zero future is to embrace an OKR-based approach.
That's exactly right. 10 big objectives, one monster objective. It's the mother of all OKRs, and that's to take 59 gigatons of greenhouse gas emissions. That's the carbon pollution that we pour into our precious atmosphere every year as if it's some kind of free and open sewer. The science tells us we've got to take that 59 gigatons down to net zero by 2050. And importantly, we've got to cut it in half by 2030, which is just 8 years from now. While the planet grows from 7 billion to 10 or 11 billion people, while economic activity increases. So this is a tall order. This is an audacious objective.
The first half of the book, you're breaking down what's required, like transportation has to break, food, energy grid, and so on. Like for food, we're going to cut consumption of beef and dairy and lower food waste and that sort of thing. You're doing the math part by part so that we can figure out how to get there without necessarily having unsavory or impractical impact?
Yes, exactly. Every one of these objectives is like a good OKR. It's bold, it's visionary, it's clear, it's long-lived. And the six sectors, the six objectives where we can cut our emissions are each supported by a handful of key results. And you'll remember from OKRs that the objectives is what I want to have accomplished. The key results are how I'm going to get it done. And good key results are measurable, time-bound, specific, clear. And for example, I'll pick one. Let's just go to objective number one, which is to electrify transportation, which simply means power our vehicles with electricity instead of with gas and diesel. If we achieve that objective, we'll take 8 of our 59 gigatons per year down to 2 gigatons per year. We won't entirely eliminate it, but we're very quantitative about that. And then to get there, there are 6 key results. The first one, key result 1.1, says we got to get to price performance parity between electric and internal combustion engine vehicles in the United States by 2024 at a price point of $35,000. And since this is a global plan, Bob, we also specify that in India and China, we've got to get to $11,000 for an electric vehicle by 2030 to be competitive. So these are carefully curated, thoughtfully chosen, vetted by scientists and policymakers. I want to invite your readers to go to the website speedandscale.com because they can get this plan, download it for free, each of the 10 objectives, the 55 key results.
And so you're doing the math sort of piece by piece and part by part to get that 59 down to zero. And I can imagine at some point as you're working on this project, on this book, you're like, okay, can we really get to zero? Or like, you know, at what point do you realize like, oh, actually, it all will add up. We can get there.
Oh, but that's such a great question. The first 5 are electrify transportation, decarbonize the grid, fix the food system, protect nature, clean up how we make cement and steel. Those are 5 great areas. But the 6th and hardest one is called remove carbon. And there's 10 gigatons of carbon emissions that are going to remain after those first 5 objectives are achieved. And honestly, we don't know how to do that economically today. So if you're a glass half empty, you say, Dor, your plan doesn't add up. You're 10 gigatons short. If you're an optimist, you respond, well, I believe in the power of innovation and investment and entrepreneurs. And somehow, I don't know how, we're going to lower the cost of taking carbon out of the atmosphere from $600 a ton today to $150 or $100 a ton by the time we need to get it done. So we're in a race for the survival of our planet. We're all in this race together, and we've got to win it.
The second part of the book, you get into this issue of speed about sort of 4 ways to accelerate things so that all this actually happens. And you talk about policy and about government and about investments. What popped out to me was, and it's a word you mentioned earlier about movements, which evokes, you know, people marching in the streets. But if I'm reading you right, you're also applying that to how businesses operate, that business leaders can themselves make decisions to advance these goals and that business itself is part of a movement?
Business is one of the most exciting things about this movement. 70% of the emissions in the world come as a result of business activity. I profiled Doug McMillon, the CEO of Walmart, as the leader of a movement because Walmart, a Fortune 1 company, has immense power. And so when they gather together their supply chain, when they make a personal commitment or a corporate commitment to get to net zero, they also are bringing their suppliers along and aim to do that by 2040. I profiled Jeff Bezos as a movement leader. He established the Amazon Climate Pledge and has a couple hundred companies in the Amazon supply chain who have signed up to get to net zero by 2040. 10 full years ahead of the Paris Accord. Now, we have to be hardcore about this. We can't just accept pledges. We need to track people's progress against these pledges. I kicked up something of a firestorm by declaring that the internet had been underhyped, and I'm of the same view about the climate transition. The transition from the dirty fossil fuel economy to the new clean energy economy is, I think, the greatest economic opportunity of the next century.
And the people who look at commitments by the likes of Walmart and Amazon, as you mentioned, to decarbonize themselves, to get to net zero, this isn't just greenwashing. That word gets thrown around a lot, that it's just greenwashing.
It's not greenwashing, though we want to be on guard for that. I've done the research, spoken to members of the supply chain, and these business leaders know what's at stake, and I think they know what needs to be done. I make an analogy in the book with the mobilization that occurred for World War II. In 1942, General Hap Arnold had a meeting with FDR, and things weren't looking very good in the battle against the Nazis. FDR pulled out a napkin and he sketched on it a handful of objectives that needed to be achieved. We stopped manufacturing automobiles for 4 years, and we turned that manufacturing capability over to making battleships, airplanes, ammunition, and tanks. We need a similar mobilization of all of the activity, all of the manufacturing, all of the consumption on the planet, a total system change to realize this new clean economy. In one case, democracy was at stake. In this case, it's the survivability of a habitable Earth that's on the line.
Hi, listeners. It's Masha Mokutonina, a producer on Masters of Scale. I spend a large part of my day carefully crafting emails, composing documents, and endlessly responding to messages. Which is why I am such a big fan of Grammarly, the secure AI writing partner I use on a daily basis. Whether it's reaching out to high-profile guests or coordinating logistics with the production team, I use Grammarly to adjust my writing to different audiences while maintaining the brand voice of Masters of Scale. Grammarly helps spot redundancies and clean up sentences that are unnecessarily wordy, verbose, long-winded, and repetitive, like this one. Grammarly's AI prompts help guide my writing process, personalizing content based on context as well as making tone adjustments intuitively. It doesn't just help me generate more content, it helps me generate better content. Amazingly, Grammarly works seamlessly across my email, Slack, and over 500,000 apps and websites, so there is no cutting, pasting, or context switching needed. Join me and over 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly to work faster and hit their goals while keeping their data secure. Visit Grammarly.com to learn more. That's Grammarly.com.
Before the break, we heard John Doerr, author of the book Speed and Scale and partner at Kleiner Perkins, talk about what's required to combat the climate crisis, the importance of measuring our progress, and how business is a critical part of that movement. Now John talks about the massive economic opportunity in decarbonizing as we go for the gigatons, as he puts it. He says labeling the emissions created by every product and service will shift behavior, as will closing the green premium. Most of all, he talks about the lessons of leadership, how impact can come from any and all industries, including big oil, and how each of us has a role we can play. I think back to when, you know, Lyft and Uber first emerged, and at the outset, the theory was that, you know, ride sharing would reduce the number of cars on the road, but that actually hasn't really materialized that way. And sometimes I find myself confused, like, is eating a plant-based burger actually better for the environment, practically versus theoretically? Like, in terms of emission impact, is a shirt from a plastic bottle really better than cotton? Like, do we even know? Am I just making myself feel good? How do I know if something's really helping or what really is going to have the most impact?
We can know from the science. All of the questions that you're asking, it's largely known, but it's not well communicated. So the book calls out the need for greater transparency.
we need to have labels on emissions, just the way there's nutrients labeling for foods. All products, all services ought to be scored so that consumers don't need to figure these questions out for themselves. The carbon accounting is as important as the financial accounting. In a year, we'll be able to pinpoint down to every emission the sources of emissions on the planet. And then there's a consortia called Climate Trace that is using AI to standardize and normalize and make freely available to the world a Google Earth-like globe, a map that shows what the emissions are from smarter agricultural practices in fields and the losses due to deforestation in the Amazon. We've got to go for the gigatons. So my individual actions to not use plastic bags is probably not going to have a gigaton level impact on the climate crisis. And the book is an effort to identify the big gigatons, the big actions that we can take. We cannot afford to be distracted by bright, shiny objects.
And so having transparency in what the actual emissions are created by each product that we buy will have this cascading impact to turn what might be individual purchases into sort of industry-wide practices and adjustments that are holding everyone accountable for the emissions on a much larger scale.
Yes. I've written this book not to convince anyone to go vegan. I've written this book for the leader inside of everyone. We are fast running out of time. We truly need collective action, not individual action.
I'm curious what the environmental impact of the tech industry is. Sometimes people talk about NFTs or crypto mining and cloud storage and so on. Is that issue one of the distractions you're talking about?
Well, first of all, Bitcoin, powered as it is today, largely by fossil fuels, emits as much carbon as several nations combined. And that's equivalent to all the energy used by Malaysia or Sweden. So we've got to power our cryptocurrencies with clean and renewable energy. But I don't think as Bitcoin as the tech industry. Honestly, I believe every business is a tech business and it relies now on technology. And the great big emissions come from how we generate electricity and how we move goods around the world, and then how we make things. So decarbonizing the grid, shutting down coal plants, eliminating methane leaks and emissions from methane. This is a wicked greenhouse gas because it's about 80 times more potent than CO2. Those are going for the gigatons.
So when I was editor of Fast Company, I had the team go through this exercise, like, are there companies that we shouldn't take ads from because we didn't want to support them, right? And tobacco companies came up and gun makers. And then, of course, big oil companies. And the challenge in our conversation was, well, are we telling our readers, like, don't fly on planes, you know, don't use any gas-powered vehicles or heat your home or whatever? I'm curious what your perspective is about big oil.
Well, my view of big oil begins with the belief that they engaged in near criminal activity in their misinformation campaigns that they staged when they knew well in advance that carbon pollution was a threat to civilization. Even the International Energy Agency has called out that we must stop using fossil fuels in our lifetime. The dirtiest of industries, though, can seize an opportunity here, and the leadership of those companies can choose to adapt and evolve. One of the best stories in the book is of the Danish oil giant Ørsted, who used their expertise in offshore drilling to become the world's leading provider of offshore winds. In other emitting industries, producing cleaner materials will help them move into a hydrogen economy or make steel and cement that drastically reduce the carbon emissions. So my advice to the oil and gas industries are find ways to decarbonize your business to be part of this new clean energy economy. I think they know, they've seen in their market valuations that they've been counting on stranded assets buried under the ground that are never going to see the light of day.
You talked at the outset about sort of winners and losers in this revolution to the future. Like, there's a lot of opportunity for growth for winners and organizations that embrace this way the world will work in the future to generate a lot of opportunity for themselves.
Totally. You know, this move to electrified transportation, that's a massive change in over 100 million vehicles. The estimated size of the market for batteries for electric vehicles is $400 billion per year for the next 20 years. All of online advertising, everything that Google and Facebook fight over in the U.S., is $80 billion. So that market is five times bigger. That's how enormous this transformation is that we need to successfully make.
Talk to me about the green premium, right? This is the extra that we pay for an electric car versus a gas car or whatever, for oat milk versus cow milk. Can the scale of impact happen if that premium persists? And how do we break it down?
The green premium is the difference that we pay for a clean, zero carbon product or service compared to its fossil fuel standard alternative. And I first heard of this term from our friend Bill Gates. So in the case of electricity, today the green or no carbon price is around 15 cents a kilowatt hour. Dirty electricity is about 13 cents per kilowatt hour. But that green premium of 2 cents is rapidly declining. For some industries, like in aviation fuel, the green premium is 400%. It costs $7 a gallon as opposed to $1.80 to fly with fuels that are made without emitting carbon. The most important innovation we can do is to lower the cost of fuel, of food, a product, an ingredient, so that we drive the green premium to zero.
And will that require subsidies? I mean, you mentioned that the traditional oil and gas industries have been receiving subsidies from governments for a while. Does this require government subsidies to be able to generate that or eliminate that premium?
Government subsidies are an important part of it, but there's not enough subsidies in the world to transform the whole economy. So I tell the story of Germany and the feed-in tariff subsidy that a German legislator enacted, which guaranteed that the German utilities would buy clean electricity at a declining price for two decades. And that was the catalyst that kickstarted the phenomenal reduction in the cost of solar photovoltaic energy, so that today solar energy is, together with wind, cheaper than coal or gas or natural gas fossil-based fuel systems. I'm very pragmatic about this. I want to see the renewable energy subsidized, and I'd like to see the fossil fuel subsidies ended.
I often ask guests on the show what's at stake, but given this dialogue, it's kind of obvious that the stakes are pretty enormous. So let me ask this a slightly different way. If I'm going to do one thing to change my life, to advance addressing the climate crisis, what should it be? Is it buying an electric car, or is it more about leadership and the movement? Or can it not be just one thing if we're going to overcome this burden, this crisis?
Well, the one thing you should do, Bob, is move others to action. And I want to appeal not to your personal virtue, which is necessary, expected, and not sufficient. The time is so short. This is the decisive decade that we need you and your audience to take this plan, understand it, pick the one or two areas where you can have the most impact, and then declare, that's what I'm going to do. Tell your friends, your family, your loved ones, enlist your coworkers, enlist them in this agenda. If your employer has not made a commitment to net zero, get them to make that commitment, and then get them to meet it. If in your school district they're still using dirty diesel buses, join forces together with other parents and taxpayers and get your school district to go to clean buses immediately. We're past the point of time where we can talk or even debate. We need collective action, and we need it now. I just want to do some basic Rice University math. If we have to cut emissions in half by 2030. And we're doing this in a world with growing demand and activity. That means we've got to cut emissions in 2022 by 8%, and another 8% in 23, and 8% in 24 and 25. Every year between now and 2030, we have to reduce emissions by 8%. Bob, do you know we've never reduced emissions by 8% in the history of the planet? During the pandemic, they briefly reduced by 6%, but emissions came roaring back. So we've got to make the right outcome the profitable outcome, so it becomes the probable outcome. This is a wicked problem.
You know, you said at the outset that you're hopeful about all this, or you were coming out of COP. It's a little terrifying listening to you. And I guess you kind of have to walk this line between scaring people into action, but not paralyzing them and having them throw up their hands and say, oh, this is too big, this is too hard, this is impossible.
I think fear is a healthy emotion, but I want it to galvanize and catalyze action, not to paralyze people. Only concerted and global action is going to get us over the finish line here in time. We need the Greta Thunbergs to be angry and to engage in civil disobedience to make this a top two voting issue in every major emitting nation. I'm not a world leader, and I'm an engineer from St. Louis, Missouri. I need to establish credibility. The numbers need to add up. They do. We can achieve this plan, and I have actually great hope that we will.
Well, John, this has been great. Thank you so much for galvanizing all of us, pushing me and pushing all of us to keep this top of mind and constant. Masters of Scale Rapid Response is a Wait What original. The show is recorded remotely using sanitized audio gear. I'm your Rapid Response host, Bob Safian. Host for Masters of Scale is Reid Hoffman. Our executive producers are June Cohen and Darren Triff. Our supervising producer is Jay Punjabi. Our producers are Jordan McLeod, Christina Gonzalez, and Marie McCoy Thompson. Our music director is Ryan Holiday. Original music and sound design by Daniel Nissenbaum and the Holiday Brothers. Audio editing by Keith J. Nelson, Stephen Davies, Andrew Nault, and Mike Gallagher. Mixing and mastering by Aaron Bastinelli. Special thanks to Emily McManus, Sarah Sandman, Kelsey Capitano, Tim Cronin, Charlie Manessis, Adam Heiner, Anna Pizzino, Ben Richardson, Mina Kurosawa, Saida Sapieva, and Colin Howard. Become a member of Masters of Scale to get access to a year's worth of courses and content on the Masters of Scale Courses app. Find out more at mastersofscale.com/membership. Visit mastersofscale.com/rapidresponse to find the transcript for this episode, and be sure to subscribe to our email newsletter.